The craft so long to learn, concluded. Palimpsest. The continuous excitement is done. Back to the tired old trade of words, where shades of meaning are constant once achieved. No flicker over the featureless message runs, and facial adjective and body verb, an arranged sorrow, a mathematic grief. Turn away with an ashamed face, my mistress may be in your hangdog love, with dramatic dolor, saying made it so. And this easily satisfied mood makes false echoes mumble on the raindrub roof, describing a woman, reiterating slow, she is beautiful as you. Gilgamesh and Friend. Ebani, or Enkidu, made by an itinerant goddess from clay, hairy, perhaps human, destined to have carbuncles, goiter, fear of death, became friend of beasts, notable in that he learned their language, played the flute, was weaned from animals by a courtesan. How? Joined Gilgamesh to initiate heroism, first known ism in the Sumerian microcosm. Killed bulls, wizards, monsters like Shumbaba, who had no genitals, thank goodness, in a cedar forest, judiciously aided by Bel, Aruru, and Shama. Through the adolescent world, these Sumerian tourists joyed in their senses. But Ebani died. Girl crazy Gilgamesh, trophy hunter, fame seeker, wept, got drunk, troubled gods with sharp cries. Sought Utanapishtim, the old ark navigator from flood days, senile but certified immortal. With snappy snarl, asked him his recipe. Denied. Gilgamesh, the tired folk hero, died, first speaking to latecomer Ashurbanipal, but a stone tablet to commemorate himself by. Laid down among discarded jewelry, brazen spears, piled armor, heard desert jackals whine, grinned, nipping heels of tearful concubines, felt numbness, emptying, first slow tremor of translation, became a story, and went stammering into the centuries. That was the last poem for the Craft So Long to Learn. This book was called The Blur in Between. The title comes from a letter from Milton Wilson, who described some of my poems as the transitional period between one thing and another. It was published in 1963, and with the poems, many of them are much older. The Old Woman and the Mayflowers. The old woman went into a field for mayflowers and couldn't get out. The crack voice that prevailed in a thousand backyard quarrels broke in a bubble of saliva that popped and ran down her cheek like silver slime, and her mouth held the shape of a cry. The steel will that evicted uncounted boys from her apple tree turned out to be nothing more than an appetite for trouble. She bogged and died. It was some sort of hag tenderness, perhaps, that made her go there. Ill-considered access of feeling for beauty, her brain softening after almost 80 years of bitchiness, an era akin to the Peloponnesian Wars for some chronicler of Ameliasburg Township. She'd picked maybe a dozen mayflowers before dying, and a goat ate them out of her hand, leaving the stems tight clutched. We think it was Mueller's goat. The tracks were deep and full of water, unmistakably cloven. Twin heads. Sea and bathroom sun, sprouting follicles, black and gray, twice broken nose, craters and blemishes of skin folded beneath eyes like a podium for battered political maid to speak on. Closer, the forehead scar as military memento, eyebrow cicatrice, a pool room fight, eyes watery green with gold coronas. By what extremity am I pushed to calling this thing human? Now twin portraits shine from this wreckage and rhetoric of ruin. I suppose it's me, and whether through inferiority or pride, I attribute to these opposed twin heads all defaults and virtues of being human. Those twin portraits seen outside, judged inside, O hanging judge, by an angry antlered tribal god come all the way from Lasco relays, hop-stepping to do the job. A long way from Auvergne and Altamira to here. A fatal rhythmic tremor. Hunger-tilted populations pouring to Etruria, the land bridge of Bering. families walking over the ice, wind clubbing them. Indo-Eurasians and Celts. Yellow-haired people. Starving Cro-Magnons on the ice cap. Tough cattle herders in Central Asia, drowned over and over in this mirror. See, twin heads, before you condemn or praise overmuch, ancient pleasure, ancient despair, your own ancestral children, old women becoming brown objects of art, and the young's raw radiance. This is your own loving, incestuous portraiture. No mirror judgment is possible, even at Golgotha or Hiroshima, but an assessment of shortcomings by killers with sensitive hands. God, the Eumenides! A girl was raped by a student at the University of Erotica, McGillery Yale. After pursuit by sirens mounted on obese pterodactyls, the culprit was quartered and drawn and was chopped served with hot sauce at the policeman's ball. Or else he was pursued for months by Eumenides with Geiger counters strapped under their waistcoats, rafting down his bloodstream in rowboats, shooting rapids in the left ventricle. All the time he wasn't guilty, didn't know what it was all about. Would have been rather silly, except the horrid body hanging from the window shade in the morning was one of his. Of course it was a dream. The girl escaped screaming. Anyway, the Eumenides were a faulty water closet in the hotel room that sang, sleep tight, all night and a wet day ahead with rain falling. A day wistfully ordinary as an old overcoat, ready to be thrown away, consisting entirely of the interval before nightfall, in which no crime was committed, in which nothing happens at all. In Ellesmere Land, waiting on the edge of the bad ice in a skin tupek, waiting the great umiak of the men with hair on their faces, which comes in spring when bad ice breaks. Someone will lay out the blue fox and skins of white bear for them, cover the walls of the tupek for Upernadleet, the white men, light the seal oil lamps till they shine on white bear and blue fox gathered inside the tupek with the hunter who took them. Place them on snow, hang them on cooking pots and meat racks, where the blue fur parts is light, and the white fur glows pink. This is Tornadek, the good spirit. Someone has done this with a long spear and knife. Someone is a great hunter. Blue fox and white bear and tupek, where someone took you, placed you, in a way you would not have known, in a way you were not before. The white men will be pleased. It will mean sharp knives and wood for sleds. It will mean more than another hunter's skins, which are piled and thrown in one place, without honor. Someone has done this. Blue fox and white bear speak together. Someone will listen to the thing that has been done, the way they are, which is good. Call Meksak, Amarok, and Mayuk, old toothless Kringerangset, all the people of Kangar Lug. The skins have become one thing. It speaks and scratches inside the head. Upernadleet will know what it means, and the bad ice breaks. The business of using the word someone, the Eskimo hunter is referring to himself when he says someone. He never refers to himself directly. Not me, it's someone. The machines. This is one of the poems that have been a great deal revised since. The machines. He sweated vomit over those damn things. Blood and oil on his hands. Gave him a stupid dignity, like a bear smeared with garbage. The days fled into smoky weeks. He learned to operate one machine after another, learned them all, how to gauge the spock of a needle plunging hard through cloth beside his hand, and metal jaws going graph, graph every 2 seconds, and managed to retain all 10 clever fingers, and perhaps a soul. At the end, all the submissive hymning roar of machines praised him for what he was, took him for master and lord mechanic of their metal destinies. Until one afternoon, he shoved a pipe wrench into closing jaws and heard them groan out steel blood and shriek once for their anthropomorphic god. Fired, he went into the street laughing, picked up a woman near Maine and Hastings, paid her $5, and went to bed. And sobbed himself to sleep. The Death of Animals, a fantasy. Fox in Deep Burrow suddenly imagined a naked woman inside his rubric fur, lacquered fingernails pushing, edging him out, and screamed directly into the earth. Lazarus Bear in black pajamas, dancing erotically with Harlot Salmon, heard the scream and shivered, fished a soul from navel and held tight. Mouse took thought and became invisible with a gray wish. Death found him too. Owl swung down from his oak trapeze and clung to life with his toes. 10 o'clock, and all's well at 30 below 0. Deer stood by mate in the white wood. One of the looks from her eyes revealed what she was and remembered, but he never understood. 10 minutes later, a tree exploded, the sound swaying away to the stars. Some died, but nobody cried for help to the taxidermist or the veterinary, or expected to see God come crawling through the snow, pretending to be a big St. Bernard, rolling a barrel marked XXX ahead of him, his red nose flashing through trees like an ambulance. And he never did. 12 o'clock, and all's well, at 40 below 0. Traffic lights changed in the city. Models in shop windows gestured hypnotically at nobody. Taxis idled empty in the street. Where is everyone? Houses in the residential area, powered with the burning engines of stoves, sailed through the night. But where is everybody? They are whispering under many blankets. They are rinsing their unsaid thoughts in Javex. They are barricaded against the silence. The couple who fell in love after a 10-year marriage. Oh, I shall hate you if you change my thought or bring rationality into my passion. This much is enough. 4 o'clock, and all's well at 42 below. Asleep or dead in the forest or the city. When most died, a man coughed, stirred, went to the bathroom. No connection, of course. When town merchant died of lobar pneumonia, owl was already dead. Again, no connection. Fox screamed, but the lady with lacquered nails already owned a fur coat. No real connection. Deer died later of a bullet wound, having trailed a broken leg through miles of red snow. He never did see that same look again, nor has any man. And Bear danced with Salmon, a hoor snored in town. Besides, Bear is a pretty comical fellow. What's the point, then? None at all, really. 8 o'clock, and all's well. Temperature rising. Towns. This is sort of Walt Whitman-ish. Something I never do know. If I were a panhandler, I'd live in Vancouver, on Skid Row when the Saners come in, where the stink of fish would stun a strong man. They passed a bylaw forbidding that, and another forbidding sin. And the city would take me to its bosom, the old derelict streetcars over Canby Bridge and Oak Street resurrect for me to ride on. Yeah, I'd be a bum at Hastings and Maine, among the loggers, Chinese and bleary Indians, the fat Klutch girls stumbling out in mourning, the Salish girls with black eyes and bruised lips their lovers inflicted when the wine was red. At Prospect Point, the city's high front porch and fog, the cry of mating tugboats in the suburban sea becomes, in the tuned mind, a stealthy, horned prehistoric head, scouting our ramparts from scum-black water. The soul of the city is its poignant dinginess, the dumb voices of grime, the story of dirt, a bright orange bobbing where ferryboats cross to the North Shore, and ending in Coal Harbor. Oh, Vancouver, I was the swimmer out of sight of land in your backyard ocean, fighting the gray waves, the driftwood turnings, and foam roads going nowhere. I was that man. And Toronto? A city of Callipagos hoors, for whom I lusted, but they rejected me, because my lust had not the requisite green rustle. And city of the cold light issuing forth from apartment blocks that saith, behold, behold my warmth, O you from the hinterland. City of cold furnished rooms and empty as strange streets. I sat on a bench with Souster in front of City Hall, and yea, I marveled at its deliberate, chosen ugliness. Long ago, I met a beautiful girl at Sunnyside, who wore on her lips a faint, downy mustache. I cannot forget her beautiful mustache. O Toronto, the financial paterfamilias of a province, which saith yea and nay and command to the small investor. Dime for a cup of coffee? Thanks, brother, you're okay. It was not your churches and office buildings that amazed me, or the strangers who hurried past with faces averted, looking at the core and center of their private universe. Nay, it was not that, O indifferent city. It was this polar mystery and last absurdity, your coldness. It was the crime of waking, with passionate leftover face and erect penis, and wandering out into your closed, calm Sunday. O Montreal, I was in love with you and a woman, and they coincided. I thought it wonderful if a cop smiled. Women's perfume left me smiling and sexless. In the abomination of your traffic, I cursed without rancor. In your zero weather, I trudged up the steps of St. Joseph's at 3 a.m. and escaped arrest. Oh, wonder! Your civic administration bewildered me. Your poverty and tenement stank equally. And gunmen in alleys near churches sang bullet hymns. I was the onlooker, eager and ready to be amused, who joined in your sourceless, immoderate merriment. City of eyeshadow and athletic priests, French poodles and exquisite buttocks, city of poets with enormous egos, and the high, wild courting yard of the mountain. Your soul is schizoid and your winter-like frostbitten leprosariums, but you're not genteel. For that, I thank your veteran whores and perverts. Grateful and self-righteous and disgusted, I stand at Peel and St. Catherine's Street like a country boy with a foolish look. Yea, I praise your celebrated wickedness, standing here totally virtuous in the habiliments of young middle age, standing here and weeping over nothing. Hazelden, B.C. The phrase in this improved Scotchman means half-breeds. I drove, this was a Canada Council Fellowship, and I wrote a few poems in the upper northern interior of British Columbia. I drove up there in an old 48 Pontiac. Hazelden, B.C. Go to the beer parlor, and it's lousy with Indians. So's the street here, full of old men with bright green socks and improved Scotchmen, full of old women with faces quenched and lined. I can see girl shapes in old bodies, wavering into shapelessness that confronts time. I drink beer with the young men just before the election. Williams, the Indian candidate, Kwakutl from Kitimat, won't get their votes. He farts with his face, they say. Three beers and I'm mad because they won't vote for Williams, one of their own. They just laugh at me. Four beers later, I make a hot speech about Indian rights. I want to start a revolution, at least a rebellion. They just look at me. But looking at the clock, I see there isn't time. I rush out to buy groceries. But I'm still complacent about my moral indignation. Just thinking about it puts me on the side of the angels, who don't live in this town. And full of social wrath, I buy what I need for continued existence at the store, get in the car, and drive out of Hazelden, past the lineup at the agency, the old men with green socks, and the shapeless women, into the mountains. Kispiok's Indian Village. The mountains' intersecting shadows are like dark fish scales. The mountains' intersecting shadows are like dark fish scales on this valley floor. I wonder if two of them, two horizontal plates of shadow, make darkness more. The village is quiet. Blue morning and blue evening, and girls on the road in brown, red, and blue dresses. Complete as history, closing on the last Plantagenet. I'm able to see them only a moment, passing as mothers and with children, very old women on the roads of the world. Leaning totems by the river, most of them will be gone in 20 or 30 years of that direction. A boat out there, moving with the current, a brown man fishing. It's getting darker now. I can't see his face. Night song for a woman. A few times only, then away, leaving absence akin to presence, in the change look of buildings an inch off center. All things enter into me so softly I'm aware of them and not myself. the mind as sensuous as the body. I'm a sound out of hearing, past Arcturus, and still moving outward. If anyone were to listen, they'd know about humans. The study of islands. Sometimes I cast back over 30 years seafaring. The promontories are not those you would expect to remember, but islands bursting up in the green ear, suddenly volcanic, suddenly dangerous atolls. Islands whose responsibility does not end with departure. Sole captain soliloquize concerning ownership there. Those keys open on white bone coral dependencies. Fridays or Crusoes, maritime law, insular in minds of simple seamen. And precedent will not serve, or sand footsteps. The mind thinks other commands than rowdy, shouting skippers. Islands often absent in the aerist, with flower of surf closing above. An accident or geologic fault again exposed them to winging white ship's light. Out from black hulks, explorers' oars splash to them, boats full of incautious fools. Lounge in white sand, drink the sun-tasting native wine, sleep with the women, and kill several dark island men. Row away again to stop ship on night or noon sea. Always the islands, always slumberous engines, hairy keels, and half-expected landfall. Where and when a man's sticky blood gushes from ear and hand. And those emplumed pink coral coasts are always deferential, kindly, unambiguous brown men awaiting your insult. Pause. Easily the leaves fall at this season, so numerous the eye arrests them here. Outside the past or present, they achieve a continual beginning. What they have forgotten, they have forgotten. What they meant to do instead of fall is not in earth or time recoverable. The fossils of intention, the shapes of rot. Scholarly disagreements. I should have enough mistakes in pronunciation in this one. Menes founded the first dynasty of Egypt in 3000 BC. First civilization in the world, an archaeologist says. Another denies heatedly. The first Sumerian dynasty was 3400 BC. Leave them to their quarrel, and feast on the stone heads taken from dusty tombs. A way of looking time in the face, so that not a moment seems to have passed. The Etruscans came from the Semite cities of Tyre and Sidon. No, they didn't, an eminent authority says vehemently. It came from the mountains of Macedon, in biremes and triremes, white sails bellying, yelling gee willikers at the sirens. But look at delicate gold warriors in the Louvre, standing proud, on whose faces time left no grievance, or hint of origins, in shapen gold. Gnosis burned by the sea-king Greeks, ancestors of Helen and Agamemnon. No, a pedant says, a palace rebellion. And smoke was the entrails of that city, sighted long after in a rivered future. A slim priestess with bare breasts brandishes a snake in affirmation. I am alive, and life is all my meaning. Life that moves and burns fiercely is the heat of nails crying out against the intolerable status quo of death, and even false gods' old advertising. And I search through churches in this city, looking for that girl's violent life, but finding the closed faces of nuns turning away like blank cylinder seals in the heavy, fallen religious dust. Well, the stone components hold their place in contented stress, and these old penguins bear their burdens easily as stone, life's joy and dolor forgotten. Outside is nebular time and space, the rancorous world and the quarreling scholars. A poem called Bullfrogs.